You know, whatever life has, you take, right? Whatever life throws your way, you have no choice but to go through it. And that's because life has its ups and its downs, doesn't it? It has its peaks, it has its valleys. One minute you're on top of the world, the next minute you feel like you've fallen into a deep pit and you don't know how you're going to climb out of it. It's funny, I often think about when you're having your best day, like the best day ever. My daughter's famous for that. Even every little thing, Haley will say, "This is the best day ever." It's like, oh, we get cupcakes after dinner. "This is the best day ever." That's kind of her, what she's known for. It's the best day ever. But how often is it do you stop to think that when someone is having their best day ever, somebody somewhere is having their worst day ever, right? It's the ebbs and flows of life. We all get our turn on top or on the bottom. And for us, this past year has been one with many valleys, many low points in it. For those of you who don't know us and don't know my wife, Aubrey, she was diagnosed with breast cancer back in March. And she's very young, mid-30s only. It's not even time for her to be screened for that yet. And yet, here she is with this diagnosis that just came out of the blue. And the year has been filled with a lot of doctor's offices, a lot of checkups, a lot of clinics, a lot of hospitals, right? A lot of things that go into something like that. And she's only now at the end of her treatment schedule, all these months later, having had 6 rounds of chemotherapy, after having had surgery, radiation treatments, 25 separate radiation treatments that just ended before we left. And it's a lot to go through in a single year. It's a lot of difficulties, a lot of questions are asked when something like this happens. And thankfully, she's at the end of the process now, and all of the scans show no trace of cancer, which is excellent news, wonderful news. We were given a very difficult situation, but God has brought us to this point. But the questions still remain. Why does something like this happen? Why does suffering happen at all? And that's a more general question that we have, and perhaps we can answer that as far as the world itself is concerned, right? Why is there suffering in the world? Well, you could say that man has rejected God since the Garden of Eden. There's been no real beseeching of God. There's been no reference to his majesty, and very few people actually treat God as the Almighty. And if they don't want his help, it then is logical to assume they may not be getting his help, right? But that works on a global scale. But the question I want to ponder today is more specifically, why does suffering happen to God's people? Why is it that a Christian might have a very difficult time suffering in their life, whereas somebody who isn't called, someone who doesn't have that connection from God, doesn't have those issues? How is that a thing? So I want to ponder that question today and ask the question, is there an answer? Is there an answer in the Bible? Is there a reason that this happens, and is this something that we can discover? So I want to start with the book of Job. Now, for those of you who don't know, the book of Job is considered perhaps the oldest book in the Bible, right? Many people say it was written even before the book of Moses was written. And it tells the story of a man named Job who was described in the early verses as righteous and blameless by God. God is saying, "My servant Job, there's no man like him on earth. He's righteous and he's blameless." We'll read that in a moment. But the book, it comes with controversy. And the controversy is that people are perplexed by it, because in it you have a man who is considered to be righteous, and yet God allows him to go through this terrible, terrible period of suffering. And it's controversial because there isn't really a clear answer that you can point to say, why did Job have to go through this? So it's not my intent to do a deep dive on a book that is 42 chapters. I just want to go over the highlights of it as an introduction to the question that we have before us. Perhaps we can discover some things that will help reveal the answers to this question. So in the book of Job, let's go to Job. Start in verse 1. I'll give you the introduction to this. So Job 1 and verse 6, we'll start in. Job 1, verse 6, it says, "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them." So the devil makes an appearance in heaven before the throne of God. "And the Lord said to Satan, 'From where do you come?' So Satan answered the Lord and said, 'I'm going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it.'" And verse 8, "Then the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil?' So Satan answered the Lord and said, 'Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, and all around on every side? That have you blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land? But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face.' So the Lord said to Satan, 'Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on his person.' And Satan went out from the presence of the Lord." So that's just the introduction to the book. Satan comes before God. God points to his servant Job. The indication is that Satan is already walking back and forth on the earth considering these people. So God points him out, and Satan makes the bold claim that Job only is faithful to you. He only worships you because you protect him. You do everything for him. You keep him safe, and if you didn't, he would surely curse you to your face. Now that is a bold claim to make. And then God allows him to do that. And then I said it was 42 chapters. For the next, 40 chapters plus, you have this situation where Satan continually torments Job, who's considered righteous, takes away so many things from him. His children die. His health itself is attacked, and he's just absolutely miserable to the point where Job wishes that he wasn't even born. But it says throughout all of this that Job does not curse God. He did not blame God for the situation that he had, and he didn't say that God, at least at first, that God was tormenting him unjustly or unfairly. Before we go further, I do want to point out that in the situation where Satan comes before the throne of God to accuse Job, there is a reference in Revelation 12 and verse 10, where it talks about Satan being thrown out of heaven as he who continuously accuses the brethren day and night. So it is an interesting side note to consider that perhaps this event in the book of Job isn't the only time Satan comes before God with accusations towards the faithful. And if he's doing this night and day continuously, it does raise the question, perhaps your name has come up in those discussions. Perhaps my name has. Perhaps Satan at some point points to one of the brethren and says, if you do this to this person, he won't be faithful. He isn't so great. So it's just something to consider that Satan is an active role in our lives in the fact that he's continually on the prowl trying to go after the children of God. But I digress from that point, because that isn't really the conversation I want to focus on. But in the narrative, God expresses confidence in Job, that Job will be able to withstand the trials. And as I said, Job does not break when Satan continually pushes at him, insisting that he will curse God if he loses everything. So the things that Job loses, I mentioned his children, his health, he loses his wealth. He's described at the beginning of the book as the wealthiest or the greatest individual inside his entire region. So he's not a poor man by any means. But he loses all of that. His friends come to comfort him, but they end up accusing him of being the sinner, blaming him for the things that he's experiencing. But Job maintains his innocence, and in chapter 10, verse 2, he starts to question why this is happening to him. And then he says he wants an audience with God, kind of to plead his case, his side. So in chapter 10, verse 2, he says, "I will say to God, 'Do not condemn me. Show me why you contend with me.'" Right? He's saying, "Why are you doing this to me, God? What did I do to deserve this?" Because if you read the book of Job, it seems that his friends certainly have this concept that only the wicked should suffer. Only the wicked suffer. Because if you do right and are considered blameless, why are you somebody who is suffering? Because that doesn't make sense. It's almost this concept of retribution, that everything's great until you cross a certain line, and then God will smite you. But that isn't really what's happening here, despite what his friends are saying. And so the book concludes in chapters 38 to 41, where God does answer the question that Job has, "Where are you? Why are you doing this?" But the way he answers it isn't the way that Job is expecting. Job is expecting to have this back and forth with God about the specific situation, saying, God, why did you do this? Or why did this happen to me? Why am I suffering this way? But actually, God comes to him, and through three chapters, he declares his own majesty and his own glory. It says that God speaks from a whirlwind, and he reveals his awesome power. He says, Job, where were you when I created the earth? Tell me how it was hung. What are its foundations, if you know? And where were you when I created these wonderful things, these massive creatures that I can bend to my will whenever I want? That's the answer that he gets from God. And I'm sure that's not the answer that he was expecting. But what happens in Job 42, if you go to the end of the book, we go to Job 42. So after the three chapters prior, and it is worth reading, certainly, if you have a moment to go through those. But in the three chapters prior, God, you know, declares his own majesty before Job. And then Job finally answers, as God says to him, okay, what do you say to that? And so Job says, chapter 42 and verse 1, he says, then Job answered the Lord and said, I know that you can do everything, and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You asked, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. Listen, please, and let me speak. You said, I will question you, and you shall answer me. Verse 5, I have heard of you by the hearing of my ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore I abhor myself, and I repent in dust and ashes. Job was so struck by the magnificence of God, all he could say was, I abhor myself, and I'm sorry. And this is part of what perplexes people. What is it that Job is sorry for? What is it that he did if he's a blameless man? But he's so in awe of God at this point, he only sees himself as weak. And he sees himself as human, as so much less than God, that that's his reaction. And we'll get back to that question in a moment, but to wrap up the narrative of the story, God blesses Job again, restores his wealth. He doubles everything that he had previously. And that's how the book ends, with Job being blessed and restored once again. But this book doesn't offer a simple answer to the question of why the suffering took place. Instead, it emphasizes God's sovereign nature, the limits of human understanding, and the importance of faith, even in the midst of hardship. It also gives us into the question of what did I do to deserve this, or is this suffering my fault? This account seems to indicate that doesn't have to be the case. You can suffer through no fault of your own. You don't have to blame yourself when something terrible happens to you. Even Job himself and his friends, as I said, they always had this approach that only the wicked are punished. So if something bad has happened, it must be because somebody is doing something wrong. But as we'll see as we continue, there's no guarantee of a safe and easy life simply because you are righteous enough, simply because you do everything that you're supposed to do. And we'll talk about why that is. But I want to point out two key things. Job asks the question after the first round where he loses his children and where he loses his wealth and his power. In chapter 2, verse 10, he responds to his wife, who tells him he should just curse God and die. Which is quite a thing for a wife to say to a husband, but let's not forget that she also lost her children. Her own life has been upended as well. But Job's response is, shall we accept good from God and not bad? Now that's an interesting concept. Should we only be accepting the great blessings from God, but anything else that comes our way we want no part of? Is that really fair of us to ask that of God, to expect that? So that's one thing to consider. The next is, was Job's suffering simply about Job? Was it just about him? No, because I mentioned his wife also suffered. His friends were there. His children died. Various servants also. But it's more than just the suffering that took place then. It's also the fact that these events are recorded. And we know that there are other examples in the Bible where it says these things were recorded for our benefit. And this is one of them. We're talking about a story that happened who knows how long ago. And we're still asking questions about it. So clearly these events don't just happen in a vacuum. And it's not entirely just because of Job that this happened. But I also want to point out the perspective that Job had through it. Because as I mentioned, he did not curse God. He did not blame God for everything that happened to him when it first happened. But in verse 14, he does make an interesting comment. In chapter 14, verse 14, he says, "If a man dies, shall he live again? All the days of my hard service I will wait until my change comes." Job being a man of God, we don't know exactly what God revealed to him about his ultimate plan. But the indication here is that Job was looking to a resurrection, a life after this. When his hard time is completed, he was looking for his change to become more than just who he is, to be resurrected. And that's an interesting thing to consider, because if Job was only focused on his own mortal life, and that was all that he had, would he have the same attitude? Would he have the same hope that he had and he showed throughout his trial? And I also want to point out that I mentioned that everything was doubled for him, but he only had 10 new children afterwards. And I think that's a very interesting concept, because if Job had 10 children who died, he had 10 new children after his trial. But that's not double. Is it a replacement? I think more so, it's in God's eyes, the 10 lost children will live again. And so Job will have 20 children at the end of all things. So I think that's also an interesting side note. But I don't want to get just stuck here in the book of Job, but I do want to ask a serious question. Given everything that we've been through and talked about with what happened to Job and what he's been through, was Job better after all of these things? And that's a really difficult question to ask, because I mentioned his 10 children are gone at this point. And we don't know the exact nature. We know early in the chapter he would do daily sacrifices for them on their behalf, so we don't know if they were considered righteous like he was, but it doesn't matter. They were his children, and they were gone. But was Job spiritually better afterwards? And I think that's an interesting question to ask, because based on what we just read about his response to God, he had a grand new revelation about the awesomeness of God that would have stuck with him for the remainder of his life. And that isn't something that we can just discount. Clearly, he was made at least spiritually better after that point, not to mention the incredible blessings he enjoyed after that point. But it doesn't answer the question as to why he suffered. Not specifically, anyway. So I want to continue on, ask the question quickly, did Job sin? And that is a question that many people have answers to, and not everybody agrees on the comment. It does seem, though, that as the chapter progresses, that he started to accuse God, not that somehow God was wrong, but that God was mistaken in what he was doing to him. Almost as if, God, you can do all these things, but it's unjust to do it to me because I'm innocent. And that was kind of his mindset. It became more accusatory as he went on, which is why I think God responded in the way that he did. So he wanted to argue his case before God as an equal, but God had other options in mind. God wanted to show him how wonderful he was and how little Job actually understands about the grand plans that God has in store for him and for all of the people. So one more lesson, I think, is that God is worthy of praise even when you have nothing left. Right? Is God still worthy of being praised if you've lost the things you consider to be most important? And the answer is yes, because God is God, and his awesomeness is without question. And we could live a life where we only expect, as Job said, to have the good without the bad, but that isn't the life that we are given. It's not the life that we are called to, even. Because would you worship him if the hedge was removed around you like it was with God? God wants to know that. If you lose the comforts and the blessings of life, all the things that you enjoy, being able to get in your car and go to the grocery store, being able to sit down and watch a movie at home, all of the first world comforts that we have, not even going to the extreme of what Job lost, but even just the first world comforts we have, would you still worship God the way that he wants you to? And for God to know that, and for you to know that about yourself, isn't it likely that you would have to go through a lessening of your comforts, so God can test and know your heart. But even if God did remove his protective shield from you, we can take solace in the fact that he is a loving God who will give it back to you. For whatever reason you lose it, he will not take it away from you forever, because he is a loving God who always thinks of you. And I think that is one of the great lessons of Job, is when God goes on his three chapters about his own awesomeness, he's still talking to an individual. He's still taking the time to talk to Job individually. He's a loving father who's not so caught up in the wonders of the universe and all of the millions, trillions of things that he's keeping track of at any given time. He still takes the time to talk to Job and to ultimately comfort him and restore him. So I think that's enough with the insights of Job, but I think it does open up the remainder of his message, which is the question, why do Christians suffer? Because we illustrated a situation where someone who's called righteous does suffer, apparently not his fault that he suffers, but he still does. And then God's answer is basically, I am God. And is that enough? Is that enough of an answer? So let's continue and talk about it. So I want to look at some reasons in the Bible that are given for why Christians suffer in this life. So the first one, suffering so that you may learn from it and that you may grow. The suffering can be a powerful part of personal growth, right? I already mentioned what happens if you lost your first world comforts. You'd probably figure it out eventually, because there were people, I'm told, that lived life before the internet. So there probably is a way to get along without those things. But what about not having enough to eat, per se? What about a family member who is sick? I mean, things like that really bring you into the moment, right? It makes you stop and consider the things happening around you and what it is you actually value in life. So suffering to learn and grow is a powerful thing, because it does make you assess yourself, what you're doing, and how you ought to behave once you get those things back, assuming that you do. But turn to Romans 5. I think that this is a very interesting verse here. Romans 5, and we'll go to verse 3. Romans 5, we'll read verse 3. It says, not only that, but we also glory in tribulations, knowing that tribulation produces perseverance, and perseverance character, and character hope. Now hope does not disappoint, because the love of God has been poured out in our hearts by the Holy Spirit that was given to us. Perseverance, character, all of these things that we say we want, that we're told that we need, we're being told here that it is tribulations that produce these things. It's what makes you more patient. It's what makes you want to continue on the path. Paul is writing here in Romans something that is very uncomfortable for us to hear, that it is these points of suffering that make you better. And there are obviously different exponential levels of suffering in this, in our human experience. But the point is clear. Why are you going to stop and consider what you need to change about yourself if everything's just going so well? And in James 1, 2 through 4, I'll just read it. James 1, 2, chapter 1, verses 2 through 4. It says, consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of various kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. Let perseverance finish its work, so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. Again, the same concept. Rejoice in your trials. Rejoice in your suffering. That is not at all our first reaction, is it? By any means. And yet, it's in the Bible. So suffering can produce things in you that no other part of your life can. And that is part of the human experience. We aren't so wonderful that we just learn everything the first time the easy way. A lot of us have thick heads. We need to have it, you know, pushed into us a little more forcefully. All right, second one. Suffering due to your own mistakes. This is also one that is uncomfortable. I mentioned that it seems that Job didn't suffer because of his own sins, right? But you can suffer because of your sins. There are results that happen, natural results even, that happens for sinful life and sinful actions. Even repented sins can have lasting consequence. Not that God doesn't forgive you, of course he does, but that there are still consequences for the actions that you have. The obvious one being, or one of the examples, many of them, is in David's own life, the situation with Bathsheba, with Uriah and his death, David putting him to death. The child that was born, God said, had to die, because there had to be a consequence in front of all of Israel, because the sin was done within Israel. So even though David repents, David is restored by God, and God spares his own life, he is told there is a consequence. We sin, perhaps, by saying something to someone we shouldn't, right? We say something terrible to them in a moment of anger, and even if we go to them and ask for their forgiveness, they'll say they forgive us, but has the dynamic of their relationship changed? Has that outburst created a lasting effect with them? It's the same concept. Things that we do that we regret doing later still can have actual lasting effects within our own life. In Galatians 6, verse 7, it says, "Do not be deceived. God cannot be mocked. A man reaps what he sows. Whoever sows to please their flesh from the flesh will reap destruction. Whoever sows to please the Spirit from the Spirit will reap eternal life." So it emphasizes a sowing and reaping concept that is throughout the Bible. All right, let's go to the next one. Suffering as a test. A test. And this is where God wants to know where your heart is. Do you suffer because God needs to know where you are? And perhaps Job is a good example of that. Perhaps he isn't. But one that does come to mind is the story of Abraham. When Abraham was told to sacrifice Isaac, and all that went through that, it wasn't like it was just a few minutes and God says, "You don't have to sacrifice Isaac." Abraham had to get up. He had to travel all the way to the mountain. He had to build the altar, all with the intention of sacrificing his own son, and all of the emotional misery that went with that, for before God said, "Now I know, Abraham, now I know that you are faithful." So that's an example of God testing you. And David himself says in Psalm 139, verse 23, says, "Search me, God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there's any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." How many of us are at a spiritual point where we're asking God, "Why don't you test me today? Why don't you make things difficult for me today? Let's see where I'm at. See if there's anything I need to change." That is an amazing spiritual point to reach. Perhaps that's why one of the reasons why David is called a man after God's own heart, because that is a very difficult point to reach. But the answer is, it's self-evident that there are moments God will need to test you. So perhaps your suffering is due to that. I'm going to go through a couple more. Each one of these could be extensively researched, but I want to cover the reasons that I think that Christians suffer today. And one of them is suffering for God's glory. Now that one we see throughout the Bible. The apostles who were with Jesus, how many of them died a martyr's death? Right? How many prophets were killed? All for the glory of God. Even an example where Jesus, there's a blind man, the apostles ask him, "You know, Rabbi, why was this man born blind?" And Jesus says it was for the glory of God. He was born blind so that I could heal him now and you could see and you believe. Imagine living your whole life blind just for a lesson to be made, an example to be made of you. That would be a very difficult burden to bear. But we're still talking about it today, far past the lifetime of that individual. So the glory of God is continually being praised even after his life. So suffering for that reason. There's also the example of Paul himself. We're not going to read it, but it's in 2 Corinthians 12 if you want to, where Paul has what's considered, what he calls a thorn in his flesh, right? There's something wrong, a malady that Paul has, the apostle, that God chooses not to heal. And Paul says to him, or says to us, "I prayed 3 times God would lift this burden from me." And God said, no. God said, "My grace is sufficient for you." Because his suffering was necessary as far as God was concerned. I do find it interesting, though, going back, so we talked about Job with Satan accusing the brethren, Satan accusing Job, that Paul calls that thorn in the flesh a messenger of Satan, saying Satan essentially put this here to make my work in your service difficult. But God said, my grace is sufficient for you. My strength is enough to keep you going. So suffering for the glory of God. And then there's another one that is difficult. Suffering because it allows us to relate to others. What if you were the only person who never suffered? Everybody else around you was suffering. Would there be a gap there perhaps you could not reach? Can imagined suffering only go so far? Or does actual life experience help you relate better to other people? In 2 Corinthians chapter 1, in verse 3, I have it here. 2 Corinthians 1, verse 3, says, praise be to God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of compassion and the God of all comfort, who comforts us in our troubles so that we can comfort those in any trouble with the comfort we ourselves have received from God. Comforting one another with the comfort that God gives us. Is that possible unless you need comfort from God? And the answer is no. Suffering is one of those common things in the human experience that we all go through. Big or small, everyone's got a different level of it. But everybody knows what it feels like to be miserable, to suffer, to wonder when this trial will end, if it will at all. Imagine a future in God's kingdom where you are in the family of God, and God gives you responsibility to teach someone from this life who does not know his way. What is more effective? Having a lifetime of personal experience in which to talk to that person, say, I went through the world, I've been tempted, I've had to make difficult decisions to choose to stay faithful to God, and you can do it too, and here's how. Is that more effective? Or is it more effective being told by that same person, God protected you from everything. It was so easy for you. You never had a problem at all. No one can make that claim in our respect. We've lived through this life. We are living through this life now. The difficulties, the highs and the lows. Because that the commonality between people is important to make that connection. So I think that's why it says that we need to comfort one another with the same comfort that we get from God. Let's also not forget that Jesus himself did the same thing, right? He came, he suffered, and he died as a human in a way, death far worse than what we can imagine. And he was totally innocent. There was nothing that needed to be punished. He didn't have to go through that suffering, but he chose to do that for our own sakes. So let's always keep that in mind too. As much as we suffer, there was a perfect being, the creator of all, who chose to suffer for our sakes. So, let's wind this down. At the end of each trial in life, we're going to have scars from it. There will be things on your heart that weren't there before, things that weigh you down. And even when time passes, the load, the bearing, it may lighten a little bit, but it still will be there because those scars are now part of you. Who you were before isn't the same person you are after a serious trial. And those scars, they can help build us up, but they're still there, and they still hurt, and they can hurt a lot. But along with those scars, do we also have a new perspective that goes with it? And I mentioned the situation that we've been dealing with in our family with Aubrey's health. One of the things that she will tell you, and I will tell you now, is there are things that we knew before. And there are things that we know now. They're the same things. And what does that mean? What it means is that there are things that we knew from a spiritual level, an existential level, of things that we knew, we read, we're told, we can recite. And then there are things that we know after having been through it. We understand deeper. We have a far deeper grasp of the concept of suffering, far greater empathy for those who go through it. And empathy was already one of Aubrey's strong points. It was already one of the things that makes her so special. She cares about others, and she can connect with them. Last week, Mr. Weber's talking about, what did he say? He said something like, comforting others is, and he left it open. Now, what is it? My first thought was, it's difficult. Aubrey's first thought is, it's not difficult. And that's just a completely different perspective to have. But that's the same thing as saying Isaac Newton says calculus is easy. Einstein says science isn't that hard. I mean, if you have it inside of you like she does, it's a natural part of you. And yet, it has been greatly magnified after the situation because of everything she went through. So you can make those connections. She can tell you stories of connecting with other people who have cancer and connecting with them on a level she couldn't have before, understanding what they're going through, lifting them up. Being able to tell stories like this now, this entire message, the genesis of it is a situation we went through. So here I am sharing these thoughts because of what she went through. So can we say, why did this have to happen? No. We cannot just lay it out and tell you why these things had to happen. But we can tell you the things that we learned from it. I think that's a very important thing. All right, two more scriptures. One, Romans 8:28. It's a memory verse. If you don't have it memorized, try to memorize it. We know all things work together for those who love God, for those who are called according to his purpose. All things will work together. That is a promise from God. That doesn't mean it's going to be easy. It doesn't mean you're not going to suffer, have difficult times from time to time. But let us not also forget the tremendous blessings that we all enjoy on a daily basis. If you ask someone how their week was, probably the negative response would be, well, I had this one thing happen to me on one day and it really made me upset. Did they mention all the other blessings that happened the other 6 days? No, this is not our human nature. But we need to take that approach. Because the final thing that I have listed here, the reasons why Christians suffer, is because it causes us to desire something better. It causes us to desire something better. If this world were so easy and so comfortable, would you be urgently praying for the return of Jesus Christ every day? Would you realize how serious it is that the new kingdom has to come? What is the deal we're even given? I mean, is God telling us that if you, in your short days of your human life, if you serve me, if you follow me, even when it's difficult, I will give you eternity as a member of my family? That's really what's being offered. Chase after God, proclaim Jesus as Lord, follow them, obey, do everything that God asks you to do, and in exchange, he will give you eternity in his kingdom. When you put it that way, it isn't really a difficult question as if the sufferings in this life are worth it. Because there are those who came before us that found that offer so valuable that they gave their lives for it. Think of the Hebrews chapter 11 with all of the heroes of faith. It says, these all died not having received the promises, but having seen it afar off. They saw the future and they were so convicted of it, they gave up their lives in pursuit of it. So I would say that suffering, if nothing else, it causes us to realize how important it is to get to the next world and to make it serious, to be serious about it. So we've explored many concepts today, and while we've seen many, many biblical reasons why a Christian suffers, we don't have all the answers, right? We can't say in every particular instance this is why this had to happen the way that it did. Who can say why someone gets unexpected, bad medical news? Who can say why a terrible accident happens to a member of the faith on the way to the feast or anything like that that might happen? Why do the innocent seem to bear so much of the grief that is around us? We don't have clear answers for this. But like what God told Job, it was more of an assurance that he was in charge of all things. That's what he told him. All of the things that happen in the universe are there because I put them there. Which really, if you stop to think about it, is the most reassuring thing you can have. That even though terrible things happen, God is in charge of all things. And we know he's a loving God because we've all felt his love. We know that. That's not even in question. So, our human perspective is often tragically limited, especially when we face trials. We see only the immediate pain, the immediate suffering, the injustice that we claim, and we struggle to understand why a loving God would allow this to happen. But well, we may only see the storm, we don't see the rainbow that God has after it. While we may feel lost in the darkness, he sees the light that will ultimately guide us. Therefore, we must learn to trust in his perfect vision, to believe that even in our darkest moments, he is working all things out for our good, like it says in Romans. Romans 8:18, we'll close with this. For I consider that the sufferings of this present age are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is going to be revealed to us in the future. A lot of things to consider, brethren, but we are very happy to be here with our San Diego family, and we look forward to seeing you after church.